Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, we're happy to have with us Mary Norris, author of Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen, which just came out in paperback by Norton early in April of this year. Mary began working at The New Yorker in 1978 and has been a query proofreader at the magazine since 1993. She's written for Talk of the Town, one of my favorite parts of The New Yorker, and NewYorker.com. Her YouTube videos are very instructive and highly entertaining, and I recommend them to you. And she likes pencils. But as far as split infinitives and dangling participles, in my mind, they just remind me of Mrs. Gladys and her yardstick in junior high school. Not fondly. And as to prepositions, I simply recall the Winston Churchill quote, "This is the kind of nonsense up with which I will not put." So welcome, Mary, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Happy to be here.
So did you ever imagine in your wildest dreams, tucked away there, proofreading, that you would become the comma queen and tour about the country and all of this?
No, this was beyond my wildest dreams. I wanted to be a writer, and I had a lot of other projects that I was working on in my spare time, but it never occurred to me that I could get a book out of my day job. In fact, years ago, when an agent interviewed me about copy editing at The New Yorker, he was named Andy Ross, and he put it on his blog, Ask Andy. He let me copy edit the whole interview. We conducted it by email, and that came out all right. And at the end, he said, if you ever want to write a book about New Yorker style, let me know. And I just scoffed. I thought, well, who would want to write a book about New Yorker style? Who would want to read such a book? So then a few years later, I started writing about commas. Somebody asked me to respond to an article in the New York Times on the New York Times website where the writer Ben Yagoda made fun of our commas. He called them nutty. And I reluctantly did that. I thought, well, somebody has to be loyal and have some school spirit and defend our policy on commas. And I felt I should do it, and I saw a way that I could do it. And that was the nugget of this book.
Well, the other thing that's so funny is it's unexpected because, and this is a family show, so I'll say it this way, who would think that you would write a chapter of a book that contained a copulatory verb and a defecatory noun? That really, I turned the page and I went, I said those words. But where did you get such a foul mouth?
Well, let's see. The New Yorker used to never use any bad words at all. William Shawn he was squeamish. Any bodily fluid, and certainly any profanity or any obscenity, he really thought that you could find some other way to say that. And I think writers could get creative finding other ways to say it. But now it has just happened that a lot more profanity has crept into the magazine. And I don't know whether it's the editor. David Remnick himself wrote about wrestling. It was boxing. It was Muhammad Ali. And somehow I think that piece had a lot of fornication words in it for some reason. And that's when I realized when I was working on a piece about a rap star, Earl Sweatshirt, that Khalifa Sana had written that was just full of quoted tweets from these rappers and hip-hop artists, and they were all filthy, and I had to proofread that. And it inspired me to write about profanity in the magazine. And, I started cursing a bit myself some time ago. I saved up for when I was an adult and I wasn't offending any children or mothers of small children who were around. But what I found out in working on that chapter for the book was that it really is hard to proofread profane language. Your eye glances off of it. It's a little bit ugly. And there are mistakes in that chapter still because they slid past us because we couldn't really stand to look that closely.
Well, there's another aspect of your work that is troublesome, I imagine must be troublesome. And I interviewed George Saunders for 10th of December. So when you were doing the Simplica Girl diaries, and I've watched him talk about it as well. You have, and you, well, why don't you talk about it? Because you talk about it in one of the chapters about how he wrote that.
Well, it was written in the style of a guy writing his diary. And he's an ordinary guy. He's not overeducated. And I realized when I was proofreading it that there was nothing I could do to, you wouldn't want to make this guy more literary or more well-spoken than he is. He's just a guy keeping a diary, and anything you did to the language would have an effect on the character. And the character spoke, I thought, a little bit like Tarzan. You know, there were no subjects to his sentences. Went to store, felt sad, stuff like that. And it really did. I worked on the story for 2 days, and I was speaking like that to myself in my head after I was through with the story. It was like I had been in a, Tarzan had gotten into my mind.
I did the same thing. And then I heard,
yes.
And he said it came to him in a dream, and it's just, the story, it's a wonderful story, but it's this incredible combination of tragedy and comedy at the same time.
Yes.
And really strange.
You can hardly believe what's actually going on in the story, the sort of sci-fi thing that's in the background and the ordinary man trying to cope with it, and so many sad things happening in his family at the same time. Yeah,
bumper fell off.
It's funny, I just read that. I was just in Michigan the other day.
Yeah.
And I've never used that section before in a talk or a reading, but for some reason, just the other day, I did use it. And, it's still a pretty good example of a dangling participle.
Yeah, it is. And also when they're carrying the bumper in the back seat of the car, and his daughter gets the little cut. But we're not talking about that story. I get off topic a lot. But it's so funny because I think we're chronological contemporaries. And so I love the stories about your early jobs. And I used to hang out at EJ Corvettes all the time. And you hung out at Corvettes too, apparently, or drove the Corvettes.
Actually, Corvettes was a job I had when I first moved to New York in 77. The Christmas season of 1977, I was a temporary cashier at the E.J. Corvettes on Fifth Avenue. I'd heard of Corvettes before that because I lived in New Jersey when I went to college, so I knew stories about Corvettes. It was in the New York, the East Coast version of all those terrible discount stores we had back in Ohio, right, like Zayers and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that kind of, those things. But what was kind of funny about the Corvettes thing was, I needed a job, and I didn't know whether to be relieved or disappointed when they didn't recognize my talent at Corvettes and keep me on there after the Christmas season.
I suppose you know what EJ Corvettes stands for?
I don't think I really believe it. 11 Jewish Korean War veterans is what I heard.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Oh, no, actually, I heard eight.
Oh, eight.
They must have lost three in between you and my time. And the cartoon dog who hugs himself. My brother and I used to watch that cartoon all the time, and we loved it. And Augie Doggy and Doggy Daddy.
I guess that was, it was Augie Doggy. It was from Augie Doggy, that cartoon dog.
I don't know. It was a different one. I think.
What was the horse?
Oh.
In the Hanna-Barbera horse. Quick Draw McGraw.
Quick Draw McGraw.
It was from Quick Draw McGraw.
Right. It was like an interlude.
Yes. And I should know the dog's name. Somebody tracked it down, and it was a sweet name.
I didn't know he had a name.
Yeah, he actually did have a name.
But Augie Doggy and Doggy Daddy was... Augie Doggy was always disappointed, and he would always go, "Oh, Father." And but I suppose since everybody asks you this, and I guess I might as well, is talk about your job as the foot checker in Cleveland.
Well, that was not exactly a career move. I was 15 and a half in the summer, and I must have been between my sophomore and junior years of high school, the first job I ever had. There were these foot checkers in Cleveland, and I've since discovered that the job exists in a few other places, mostly around the Great Lakes. I think they had them in Milwaukee, some places in Illinois. What we did was when you went into a swimming pool, a public pool in Cleveland, you had to have your feet checked before you could go into the pool. They had a special bench, and the foot checkers sat on the bench, and the people who came to the pool had to put one foot at a time up on this foot-shaped wooden pad and bend over and spread their toes out, and I would look at their feet, and I was supposed to not let them in the pool if they had athlete's foot. And I never did know what athlete's foot looked like, to tell the truth. But we had other jobs. We had to clean the bathrooms and the decks around the pool and things like that.
I like the way you say that there must have been sometime in the past a horrible epidemic of athlete's feet, since it's a job not associated with any other city.
I don't know. It would be interesting to find out who pushed that through the city council.
It's not the most unusual of things that have been pushed through city councils.
One of the funnier, though.
So in the middle of the book, you, in an aside, say that you are prehensile, but I didn't understand how are you prehensile, in what way?
Oh, I just meant that I have opposable thumbs. Isn't that what that means?
Yeah, I guess so, but I thought maybe you had a tail or something.
Maybe I have used the wrong word. It's possible. It's completely possible. No, I wish I'd meant having opposable thumbs. I can't text the way that kids can with both thumbs.
Neither can I. If you turn your phone sideways, it makes the keyboard bigger, and someone told me that, and I can do it with two thumbs now.
Oh, well.
It makes the keyboard longer.
Maybe I'll try that, because I thought, do I have extremely fat thumbs or something? Why can't I do this?
Girls can do it. Guys can't, because guys have fat thumbs. That's the reason why, supposedly, why they can't do it. But talking about texting, my nephew Spencer, two things. One, when he was 12, he decided to buy stock in Ticonderoga pencils. It was right before the merger with Dixon. And he was 12 years old, and he told his father to buy it, and he made a fortune.
Really?
Yep. And but Spencer also texts me, and when he texts me, it's like, let me see one of his texts here. Like he'll say, when are, like the letter R, U, the letter U, N, when are U, N, and the letter I going to the number 2? And I say, Spencer, that's disgusting. How can you write like that? And he says to me, did you understand what I said?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah. He says, so? What's the problem? So I guess that's what I need to ask you, because I don't know. Is it progress that the language is disintegrating, or is it something else? I mean.
Well, I don't think the language is actually disintegrating. I, too, write out full words when I text, which probably would make me, you know, an object of fun to your nephew Spencer. And, you know, switch screens to put in an apostrophe.
Likewise.
But if I'm in a hurry and I realize I just have to get this information across and get off the phone, then I'll leave all that stuff out and, you know, use no punctuation, because it's an emergency and I have to get the message to someone and I can dispense with the niceties. So they're just dispensing with the niceties, whether it's an emergency or not. And as long as it's not trying to pass as literature, I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah, but you can dispense with the semicolon. How is that any different then?
Well, the semicolon, I could dispense with the semicolon. I don't really. I mean, I make a little joke about the semicolon, mainly to make the point that you could substitute a point for it. You could have a period and start a new sentence.
Well, you know, it's funny, thinking of The New Yorker, and I've subscribed to it since I was 12 years old, except for the years of 1992 to 1998 when I stopped. But then I returned. And Caslon has always been my favorite typeface, and I can't remember whether I like it because of The New Yorker or whether I like it because of me. But
uh-huh.
And how do you feel about that font? I guess that's all you see.
Well, I like it, too. I like it a lot. And one of the things I have problems with sometimes at work is they may have a new designer, and designers like to design, and they will sometimes try to change a typeface that we're used to looking at, you know, we've been looking at for I'm not 80 years old, but the New Yorker has had that typeface for 80 years. I've been looking at it for as long as 30 years. And when someone tries to change it just because they can, it's very disheartening to me. I mean, I love the New Yorker, but when I now open it to the table of contents page, I'm kind of repelled by all the boldface in it and by what looked to me the fonts, or whatever they are, that they're using in certain places just to be modern, makes it look like any other magazine. You know, it doesn't have the same distinct look that the New Yorker had before. I mean, the Caslon, the body type is still in place, and they're still using the Irvin face for the titles and department heads. That's the one that was invented by Ray Irvin for the New Yorker. But when there's a special issue, they use that as an excuse to use some other typeface that doesn't look good to me.
It's funny because when you talk about 80 years, it's there's a, in my bookstore, my independent bookstore, I have a subscription there to just to read. And when it comes in, you know, it's $7.99. And there's a 16-year-old girl who works at the store. And I said, and I sounded just like my father. I go, when I first subscribed, it was 35 cents. And now it's $7.99. But, yeah, it's, but you talk about, what do you think when you, for example, and I'll just give one quote from, I won't get too political, but just one quote from Donald Trump when a Muslim was elected mayor of London. And he said, his exact quote was, "I was happy to see that. I think that it's a very good thing. And I hope he does a very good job, because frankly, that would be very, very good." Doesn't it sound, it's like a six or 7 year old level.
It is quite simple, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I was wondering how you could possibly proofread. It's perfect the way it is.
Right. There isn't any way I could improve it except by cutting it substantially, you know. Eliminating it entirely, exactly.
or a serial comma, perhaps adding. The other thing that I remember, right now I'm 20 minutes from King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, and you drove through with your father, mm-hmm. and you went to Horn and Hard Art and the Automat. And I went downtown to Philadelphia every weekend with my dad, and we went to Leary's Bookstore, which I would pick up 13 science fiction books and carry them out and be scared that my father was going to tell me I couldn't buy them. And then he would say, "Look, if you read them all, and as long as you read them, I'll buy them for you." And one of the nicest things anyone ever said to me. And but we go to the Automat, and you would just get nickels from the cashier, and the marble was worn away from people pulling the nickels to them with their hand, and then you would just put the nickels in and get your baked beans or chicken pot pie or you know, those.
Isn't that funny? You're making me hungry.
But it's funny
and nostalgic at the same time.
Yeah, there's so many things in the book that are like that. The original Automat is now in the Smithsonian Institution.
Is it?
Yep.
You know, when I put that in the book, my editor gave me a look. He's kind of apologetic and said, "You know, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to define this. Not that many people know anymore what a Horn and Hard Art or what an Automat is." But, you know, when I was in about fourth grade, the geography class, I think it must have been the World's Fair in New York, and we must have learned a little about it.
I went to it.
You did?
Yeah.
Well, I just thought subways and automats just sounded so wonderful to me.
Well, so does King of Prussia. People don't understand when I say you just go to King of Prussia. They have no idea that that's a place, mm-hmm. because that he was the head of the mercenaries that helped us out in the Revolutionary War. But what a strange name for a town, King of Prussia.
I didn't know that was so. We stayed there. We got off the
Norristown.
We got off at Norristown because we were just so charmed that there was a town name for us. But the closest hotel was in King of Prussia. I didn't know he was a Prussian, so thank you.
Yeah, well, Valley Forge is right there, and all the log cabins and all that stuff.
Uh-huh, right, of course. I'll have to go back down there and investigate. I'll bet the Horn and Hard Arts is gone, though.
Yeah, the Horn and Hard Arts are all gone. All the automats are gone. Everything's gone. But It's funny, you know, and other things that resonate with me is when you're talking about feminism and you said, oh, I read The Yellow Wallpaper. And I remember reading that for the first time and how it creeped me out completely. Did it creep you out?
It is pretty creepy.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can understand the feminism aspect of it in the most miserable way possible. But the last scene when the husband comes knocking at the door, it's just...
I don't remember it in vivid detail. Wasn't there a mad woman in the attic?
Yeah, and the woman that came out of the wallpaper and she was creeping around, and then her husband comes in and faints, and she has to creep around and go on top of his body as she creeps around the room.
Ooh.
It's nasty.
Well, you know, a lot of things that are famous for being the first of their kind.
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily mean they're that good, right?
Yeah, all I remember is it scared me. I was little then, too. And the other one is the book, when you refer to it, the one Caught in the Web of Words by James Murray, which was one of my favorite books, too.
Oh, that's about James Murray. Yeah,
yeah.
Caught in the Web of Words. Yeah, I was so interested in dictionaries and people who compiled dictionaries. When I got the contract for the book, I realized, oh, I could read all those dictionary books. And they turned out, you know, I did enjoy reading them, but when it came right down to it, I could not use a lot of the material or in my own book because it's pretty specialized. Not everyone thinks it's interesting, it turns out.
Oh, well, talk about the webs at The New Yorker, because kids who read it are going to think you're talking about the web.
Well, that comes up sometimes at closing meetings when I'm, you know, I make a reference to web as in Webster's, as in Merriam-Webster's, as in the dictionary, and a fact checker who's 40 years younger than I am will think I'm talking about the World Wide Web, and we're on different pages completely. It's just an interesting thing that same word is still applying to research we do, and one is, well, we still think of Webster's as a very reliable source, and things that appear on the web, I mean, we're all getting so, we rely heavily on Google, but you can't believe everything you read on the web, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, what about, talk about the hierarchy of the webs at The New Yorker, or at least...
We rely first, well, first we have a style book, which is our list of words that we spell in our own chosen way at The New Yorker. That's, for instance, the word catalog we spell with the U-E on the end. And a lot of people just lop off that U-E. And if the word is not in our list of words, we look in what we call the little red web. This is Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, and I think it's in its 11th edition now. And it turns out, I found out in my research about dictionaries, the name Webster lost its copyright, which is ironic because Noah Webster was somebody who helped establish copyright so that he could make money off of his books. And once it fell out, you know, of copyright, anyone could put the name Webster into the name of a dictionary. So there's the Webster's New World Dictionary. There's Webster's Random House Dictionary. They all throw Webster's in. Probably they stole a lot. But Merriam-Webster is the one that the Merriam brothers bought from Noah Webster's descendants. So that's the one that has the lineage. Has the DNA of Noah Webster in it. So that's the first book we look at. If it's not in there, we go all the way back to Webster's second International Unabridged, which was published, I believe, in the 30s, and it's a huge, beautiful dictionary. There are several of them in the office, and if the word is not in there, only then do we turn to Webster's third International, which was published in the 60s and which was very controversial. That's when the debate between the descriptivists and the prescriptivists came to the fore. Webster's second told you what words were vulgar that you shouldn't use, and that was prescriptive. Webster's third just described how people talked, what people said, what words people used, without giving the reader any guidance about whether it would make you sound low class or vulgar if you use that word. So that Webster's Third has more scientific words in it. And it's really kind of funny because Webster's Second, the one that we use, which I continue to love, it's a pre-nuclear. You know? It predates the Second World War and all kinds of scientific advancements. And the other thing that's ironic is that we don't, Webster's Third has some good scientific words in it, but we kind of ignore it. And the really ironic thing about that is that every subsequent edition of the Collegiate Dictionary is based on Webster's Third, not on Webster's Second. So in a way, we're using it all along.
It's funny, I thought you glossed over the Oxford English Dictionary, which is the one I always return to.
Uh-huh.
And I pride myself, even though I'm going to be 64 years old, that I can still, I don't need any glasses for reading up close. So
good for you.
I have the one volume edition, which has 9 pages to a page, and I can actually read it without the magnifying glass.
Wow.
So I've won lots of bets doing that. I don't know how I can do it, but I can still do it. You must have had the World Book when you were little, too, right?
At home in Cleveland, yeah, we had the...
The red one?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other thing, I know I'm just talking, but there's so many things in the book that resonate with me. Like when you talk about Charles chips?
Yes.
We used to get them delivered every week.
Aren't you lucky?
And my brother has left written instructions for what to do upon his demise. And one of the instructions is he wants to be cremated and he wants his ashes put into a Charles chips can.
I thought you were going to say he had a large collection. But he guess you always give them back when you get your new chips, right?
Yeah, that was the way it worked.
Yeah.
He had to go on eBay. Yeah. He had to go on eBay to buy the urn of sorts that he intends us to use.
I have a rarity. I have a Charles pretzel tin.
Yes, that's not the same.
No, I know.
But the pretzels were okay, but the chips were exquisite.
I don't remember ever getting to actually eat any of those Charles chips. Our neighbors had them delivered, but those were the Dash family, and they didn't have any kids, so we didn't get invited over there.
Well, that same brother, Richard, he's the one that has the electric pencil eraser.
I knew you were going to say that.
And I used it once, and I put holes through all of his drafting, because he's an engineer, and I can't use them. I put holes in the paper.
Yeah, you can't bear down, I guess. I've never used one. An electric eraser seems ridiculous to me.
Well, it's funny, you know, now you reading your book has cost me an enormous amount of money, because now I've been buying Palomino Black Wings, which I wish I never knew about, because it cost a lot of money. And but the one I use, I've always used, is my first Ticonderoga, which is for children, because it's really thick and I like the feel of it.
Uh-huh.
It is a number two, and I prefer a number one as well, but it's just it's a kid's pencil, so they can grip it. But for some reason, I find it tactily very pleasant.
Well, there's another one you're going to like if I tell you about it. It's called Generals. Generals is a pencil factory that's in, I believe, Jersey City. And they put out something called a cartooning pencil, which is nice and thick and has a nice lead in it. So
I'm writing it down.
I know you are. It's yellow. It's thick. I got it as my pencil of the month, I think it was, for April. And I got hooked on it right away. I mean, most of those pencils of the month I keep in their boxes. I don't even sharpen them. But this one was pre-sharpened.
Are you seriously in a pencil of the month club?
Why, yes. But it's fully subscribed. It's one of the, something that Caroline Weaver of the Pencil Boutique runs. And somebody gave me I didn't do it myself, but for Christmas, a friend who knows I'm crazy about pencils gave me a subscription to the Pencil of the Month Club. But now I hear that it's full. She can hardly keep up with it.
Well, you mentioned therapy early in the book, like parenthetically, very quickly. But after I read the line that you wrote, I purchased the intact spirals on the shelf, and there they remain until some puzzled cleaning lady throws them away. I was thinking perhaps you might think about therapy again.
Well, you might be happy to know I've stopped doing that. I've stopped keeping my shavings.
It's just, you know, it's a question. If you have the talent to, if you have the talent, you might as well display it, I think.
They didn't go in the new building so well, you know.
Yeah, I can imagine.
From the place in Times Square, the showbiz place, to the place in the World Trade Center. It's just too sleek to accommodate my pencil shaving.
No, it doesn't work. Tell us a little bit about Lou, for lots of reasons, but specifically because of that story about when she's in the home and about the lady who asked her that question.
I know what you're talking about.
Well, I was on the plane when I was reading it, and there's this guy next to me, and I burst out laughing. And he looked at me like I was insane. But go ahead.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, Lou Burke was the major crank at the New Yorker for many years. She was a proofreader, and she read the fiction. And she took it on herself to train younger copy editors. Mainly, you know, what happened was that somebody would copy edit the fiction when it first came in, then it was Lou's job to proofread, to query proofread that fiction, so she would see what dumb things you did or what things you failed to do. And so she was the one who trained people, and she was the one who scared people. You know, she didn't care what you thought of her. She would just yell at you. One time she thought I had agreed that minuscule could be misspelled M-I-N-I-S-C-U-L-E because it's in the dictionary, just to guide you to the correct spelling of minuscule, which is M-I-N-U-S-C-U-L-E. But apparently some friends intervened and kept her from yelling at me because they knew that I did know how to spell minuscule and I wasn't promulgating a misspelling. But anyway, Lou retired from the New Yorker as soon as she could, basically. She was tired of proofreading and moved up to this retirement home in Connecticut called Heritage Village. And they asked her at first if she wanted to proofread their newsletter, and she said no. I'm sure she barked at them. And she got more and more disillusioned because even when she made a friend up there, you know, it was an old age home. The friend would have a way of popping off. So she stopped even trying to make friends. She thought everyone was stupid. And one time when she was in a place, her final home there, Pomprog Woods, an assisted living facility, somebody came to her at the elevator and she said, "Would you do me a favor?" And the woman was very surprised because Lou had such a reputation. So she said, "Why, yes, of course." And Lou said to her, "Drop dead."
I didn't expect it. And and you really get a good visual picture of what she must have been like, which is not unlike Mrs. Gladys in junior high school. It's funny, too, when you talk about David Foster Wallace, because I have every book and everything about him ever written. But his mother, who you talk about, she wrote this book called Practically Painless English. And it reminds me a little bit of you because she illustrates her rules with lots of nice sentences. Like, so to illustrate commas, she writes, "Gorgeous George, the most handsome wrestler in America, weighs 670 pounds. And the whole book is just filled with sentences like that. And then his father wrote this book called Ethical Norms, Particular Cases, which is so dense it's totally unreadable. So I figured out that if you combined his mother's style with his father's style, you basically come out with David Foster Wallace's style.
Well, that is interesting.
Yeah, he was a genius and it was a tragedy, but did you get a chance to work with his work as well?
Not so much with him, but a little bit. Some few fragments of some of his huge books would appear in as fiction in the New Yorker, you know, extracts, is that what they call them, from his books. And the fiction editor is Deborah Treisman, would give him queries. You know, we were free of to query anything we wanted, but she always warned you, he takes these things really seriously, and rather than just take your fix or take your suggestion, he'll think over what you're suggesting, and he'll come up with something completely new. Anyway, it would be a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
That's what she was saying. So I did get to work with him on some of his pieces. I didn't ever work with him directly. And I have not read that much of his work, I admit. I've read Consider the Lobster, that collection, and I came across his book, you know, a supposedly fun thing that I'll never do again.
Which was hilarious, especially the cruise part.
The cruise part, yeah. It really is hilarious. And I do love the whole story of his involvement with Brian Garner, the guy who wrote Garner's Modern American Usage. He's now changed the title on the fourth edition to Garner's Modern English Usage, under the assumption that American English is now the English and we don't need to discriminate anymore between American and English.
It's funny, the reason I asked about David Foster Wallace is because he kind of wrote perfectly, as you talk about with George Saunders, you know, it's just perfectly done. And it's hard to query because it's hard to question what they've done.
Well, that's fine, you know. The only problem with those kind of writers are wonderful to copy edit and to proofread. The only problem is that sometimes your guard gets, you let your guard down and you just start reading and you might actually miss something. You know, they are very near perfect. Every once in a while, there's a little typo or there's an article left out, and that's what you have to watch for.
Oh, speaking of which, why don't you talk about how that feels, your first triumph?
Oh, the first triumph. I was afraid you were going to ask to describe my first big mistake. Well, the first triumph was I discovered when I was training as a proofreader in the Foundry Department, and that is the last reading before a piece goes to press. It's going through the whole editorial process, and all you do in Foundry is make sure that the last refinements that the proofreader and the editorial team have made are correctly on the new version. That's all you're supposed to do. And I was reading something with Christmas gifts. Christmas Eats is what we called it. They had these long, long columns about gifts at Christmas, and the writer was saying she was in Bloomingdale's shopping for staples, and she looked for sacks of sugar and flour, and it was spelled F-L-O-W-E-R. And that had apparently gone all the way from the manuscript through almost to print, and I was not even a proofreader. I was still working in the editorial library then, but I caught that, and my boss then, Dave Jackson, made the query more prominent on the page proof, and I was, of course, I was thrilled. I found a huge mistake. I made a save, and, you know, they don't carry you off the field as they do in football when you do something like that in editorial work. I just went back down to my desk, and in the editorial library, we sliced up the magazine with razor blades and indexed cartoons according to subject, and even did things with the poems. We had to summarize the poems, if you can imagine summarizing a poem. But anyway, I was so excited, I couldn't tell anyone, you know. I made this huge save. I am a hero. I just celebrated privately by going across the street to the Algonquin, which had this tiny little blue bar, really about only four seats at the bar, and I had a bottle of Heineken and some peanuts for lunch, and that was my celebration.
Well, then go ahead and talk about your semi-unrequited love with Philip Roth, then. That's
I don't know whose side it's semi-unrequited on.
I'll leave it up to you.
Yeah, that was a different kind of catch. I was reading the page proofs of I Married a Communist that we ran the first few chapters of in The New Yorker, and they were beautiful. They were, you know, the proofs were immaculate. The book was on the verge of getting published. It probably was already bound in hardcovers at the publisher. So there was not much to do, but I did my best to stay alert, and I just noticed he had this long passage from a children's history book that he quoted at the beginning, and then he quoted an abridged version of it again at the end. And there was one tiny inconsistency that I pointed out, whether it was an article that was "the" in the beginning and "ah" at the end. I don't know what it was, but anyway, I pointed it out and gave the proof to the editor. And then a day or so later, the editor's assistant came back to me and gave me the proof, and Bill Buford, who was the editor, had written at the top of the proof, "Philip Roth on Mary Norris. Who is this woman? And will she come live with me?" So, I developed a huge reciprocal crush on Philip Roth after that, and I read everything that I could lay my hands on.
No, when I read it, I was excited because I thought it was going to go on to steamier stuff. But
well, I don't know what. I don't know. Somehow, neither of us ever followed up on that.
The other thing that was interesting was when you were talking about dashes, and it was very poignant, actually, when you excerpted, or maybe it was the whole letter, the letter that Jackie Kennedy wrote to Nixon.
Yeah, that is a very poignant letter.
And I was thinking about the dash when I, as obviously you were, when I read that, and I realized sometimes it's more like an art than a science, because the dashes she did were perfect. She and Marilyn had the same type of breathlessness when they spoke. And that's what the letter conveyed to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, when I was reading the book aloud for the audio book, I actually tried to track down some audio clips of Jackie's voice so that I could imitate it, but that was a very bad idea. Better to leave it in print. I did something with it, but yeah, to use nothing but dashes in your writing does convey that breathlessness. There's always just a pause, and then you run on. And
well, remember when on TV she did that tour of the White House?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, that was amazing, because when you listen to her voice, it was, you know, it was a combination of being seductive, but at the same time, you know, being so erudite as well.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
So what could you possibly say that would have embarrassed Aristophanes? I don't know what you could say.
Oh, just, I know what you're talking about here. My mother had a very vulgar streak in her, and some of the things she would say about the neighbors, I can't repeat, but I would be. Wouldn't it be funny? I mean, Aristophanes is just all full of fart jokes and really kind of bathroom humor. And when we used to sight translate Aristophanes in class, in this Greek class I took, and it just would have been funny if he said something that was even more outrageous than anything that Aristophanes had written. I could just hear myself doing that.
Yeah, and you did a good job of it. It's it's like when we read the Canterbury Tales, and I forget which tale it is, and he's pushing the woman up. He's on the ladder. She's above him.
Yeah, I think that's the Miller's Tale.
Yeah. And, you know, as a kid, you read that, and it's really quite racy, but you have to be willing to read the book, and most of my friends weren't willing to read the book.
Yeah, and you can hardly believe it when you're reading it. It's true. But, you know, one of the things I consoled myself with when I was trying to write for The New Yorker and not having success — this does bring us back to vulgarity and the squeamishness of William Shaw — I thought, why, he wouldn't publish Chaucer. So that was my consolation.
Oh, that reminds me. One of the interviews that I really enjoyed was when I interviewed Daniel Menaker regarding his book My Mistake.
Uh-huh.
And because there was so much in it about William Shawn, who said early on that he needed to find a position elsewhere, and then he stayed on for another 24 years.
Yeah. I think they tried to fire Dan Menaker, but it just didn't take.
Yeah. Yeah. But he was a lovely person to listen to. And then the other thing is At the bookstore, we have that book, Rejections, I think it's called, all the cartoons you guys rejected.
Oh, yes, the Rejection Collection.
Oh, those are the funniest cartoons I have ever seen in my life. And you had to reject them because they were too vile. But aren't they funny?
They are hilarious.
And the other thing I like is the fact that when you open all your YouTube videos, you have Henry Pratowski's book, The Pencil, prominently displayed in front of you.
We have a good time choosing which books to pile up. I have to say, I always insist on putting some pencil books up.
Yeah, the pencil thing is kind of weird.
Why do you say that?
Well, it's not, I don't know. It's not, you're kind of obsessed, I think.
Well, I come by it honestly, is all I can say. You know, sometimes I think, did I make this up? Am I just trying to be outrageous? But I honestly, truly do like pencils.
Well, the problem is, like I said, you've got me doing the same thing, and I've been looking at those little tiny sharpeners, the bullet ones, and I don't need to be doing this. I have other stuff I need to do.
Well, I got kind of upset. I was somewhere over the weekend, and I was in Detroit, and I was sitting at this banquet table, and I was supposed to give a talk. I was there with three other writers, and I had to go first, and I was still writing my talk while eating lunch. And I had this pencil. It's a Ticonderoga Noir. It's the wood is dyed black, and the graphite, of course, is black. But the shaft of the pencil is painted with this iridescent kind of holographic paint. It's really a very attractive pencil. Somebody gave it to me in Seattle. And the woman at the pencil boutique, Caroline Weaver, said that she thinks they don't make those anymore. So somehow my pencil disappeared while I was eating, and I was afraid that it got bust. I was afraid that the caterer took it off the table when she removed the forks and things. And I was upset. I dug around in my bag, and I found my General's cartooning pencil that I was using instead. But it didn't feel right. It wasn't what I wanted. And finally, I felt the pencil had fallen off the table. It was under my foot. And I was so relieved, you know. This is just the kind of paranoia I'm capable of. Somebody stole my Ticonderoga Noir.
Were you actually panicking?
Well, I was.
You should carry a brown paper bag with you in case you have an anxiety attack.
Well, when I get that way and I have to speak, I realize just use what you have. Don't panic. If it's gone, it's gone. You can go on eBay later, see if you can find another.
Well, my daughter is like the friend of yours who recommended mechanical pencils. She loves mechanical pencils, and I despise them. It's not that I despise them inherently. It's just when I try to use them, it's absolutely impossible, right?
I feel the same way. What, you know, how do you know when to click it and make lead come out?
Yeah, and it's not really that much more efficient. You have a pencil, you use it till it's done, then you buy another pencil, or you have a big pack of them. I don't see that it's... If you go to the dollar store, you can buy 10 mechanical pencils for a dollar, but I don't really see that there's any much utility in them. But that's just you and me.
I think it's... the people... I'll tell you the truth. I think people who use mechanical pencils have no soul.
I don't think you should be saying all this stuff on the radio.
Just don't give anyone my address.
But yeah, it is true. I mean, and I would much rather use a pencil than a pen, and I learned a lot about erasers from you. So I enjoyed the book a lot, but I found the pencil part as enjoyable or more than the rest of the book.
Well, it was a fun part to write, I have to say. It was, you know, the other parts of the book that had to have all that instruction about grammar in them and had to be a good blend of examples and New Yorker lore, that was harder to patch together.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, but the pencil, the ballad of a pencil junkie just came rushing out.
Well, plus the visit to the museum and your donation, your unique donation to the museum.
Yes. Have you been to the Pencil Sharpener Museum
I feel like making a pilgrimage. It's not that far, just like it wasn't that far for you out of the way, right?
It was actually quite a detour. In fact, somebody said later, a friend told me that a friend of hers said to her that after reading about my detour to the pencil sharpener factory, he understood why I wasn't married.
Well, with that comment in mind regarding therapy, I think we've found some inherent flaws. You can discuss this in the next book, now that you're a multimillionaire like Lou.
Not a multimillionaire, but we didn't say that Lou got to be a...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, say that briefly, and then we'll...
Well, just the reason that that I followed up on Lou was I did try to stay friends with her when she was up in the nursing... She wasn't in a nursing home, but the assisted living facility. I visited her a few times, but she was just starved for company, and she would keep you, you know, she was like the Ancient Mariner, talking and talking and talking for hours at a time, and it was hard to get away. But so I hadn't seen her, and then she died, and then it turned out a while later when they probated her will that she was a millionaire, and she had left all her money to the public library. Cut out, she had one niece, and she cut her out of the will. And I had hoped, frankly, that she'd leave me her car. She had this nice little red Honda Civic hatchback that she hardly ever drove. So, you know, it was in mint condition. And I did ask her once jokingly if she would leave it to me, but I didn't go visit her enough, so that never happened. But anyway, yeah, that we went back to the library. There was going to be a big celebration of Lou's bequest of $1 million or more to the library. It was in Southbury, Connecticut. And then the first selectman of Southbury, got wind of the size of the bequest, and he wanted it for the town, not for the library.
I know after I read that, I was wondering whether people called him and like called in death threats or something. You painted him as such a villain.
He wasn't very popular. He was a villain, and he had to give in. But the library also had to give in a little. They have to tell them now every time they spend any of the money, they have to submit their receipts. You know, if they buy a birthday cake for somebody in the office or a bottle of wine, they have to get permission.
Well, so now that you've done all this, do you have a sequel or perhaps another memoir of sorts in mind?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I'm going to write a book about Greek, the Greek language, mythology, etymology, Greek culture, like yogurt, for instance, and I'm going to get to travel there. I've had a big Greek period, went back in the 1980s. I studied modern Greek, and I traveled in Greece, and the travel in Greece made me want to study ancient Greek, which I did when I got home. And I actually performed in plays in ancient Greek up at Columbia University. And I kept switching back between modern and ancient, so I got them hopelessly confused together. But I still love this stuff, and I like traveling to Greece. So I'm going to try to put together a book that will be about all of the things from the Greeks that still speak to us.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
And doesn't it?
Yeah, it sounds great.
Right.
Are you going to keep your day job?
Well, so far I still have the day job, but the deadline for the Greek book is coming at me fast. So I think I might have to think about retiring from the day job. We shouldn't put that. I haven't told them that yet.
you nitwit! You can't talk to me on the radio and tell all these things.
Maybe. When are you putting this on?
Oh, it's going to be broadcast when? May 30th at 5 p.m. That's your deadline, May 30th. You got to tell them.
All right, I'll tell them. I don't know. I'm thinking about holding on until through this year anyway, but certainly next spring I want to travel to Greece, and I want to spend an extended period of time there.
Yeah, spend a lot of time there. That'll be wonderful. I envy you.
Yeah.
Well, so look, you've spoken to me for 54 minutes without hanging up. A long time. Well, thank you so much for being here. I loved your book. I love talking to you, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you. It was really fun talking, Sam.
Likewise. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We were talking to Mary Norris, author of Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. And again, I ended up talking more than she did, but I really enjoyed listening to myself. In any event, yeah, it's a great book. It discusses her 30-year tenure at The New Yorker and how hard it is to be a proofreader, and especially with, you know, famous people like George Saunders. I know she does a lot of Karen Russell stuff and Philip Roth stuff. So, yeah, it's definitely a difficult job. She does it very, very well, and she was a pleasure to talk to. So next week on our show, we will have, I don't know, somebody cool, but the upcoming authors who may very well be on the show next week are Stuart Onan to discuss his latest City of Cigarettes. He also wrote, amongst other books, Emily Alone, The Odds, Last Night at the Lobster, a whole bunch of books, all of which are really great. And then New York Times bestselling writer Mary Roach to talk about her latest grunt, which is The Curious Science of Humans at War. And she also wrote Bonk and Stiff and another book about Bonk was about dead body. Bonk was about sex. Stiff was about dead bodies. And Grunt is about war. And she writes in a very humorous but enlightening way. So that'll be great. And then we have Ya Gyasi, who is going to discuss her highly anticipated debut novel, Homecoming. And we have a complete schedule, which you can look at wellingtonsquarebooks.com or WCHE1520, or you can download our podcast anytime at iTunes or Podomatic. And thank you, as always, for joining us here, and hopefully next week on The Avid Reader.